He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
Telling it like it is. Giving you both sides of the story. This is Katz at Night.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now, here's John Katzimatidis.
This is John Katzimatidis, Katz at Night, and we're here at TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. With the number one show at 5 o'clock, and this is a TriCast. We're on AM 970 The Answer. We are 77 WABC and on WLIR, right?
107.1. Yes, sir.
And we have Common Sense Democrats, Common Sense Republicans in this room now. We have Judge Richard Weinberg, Common Sense Democrat. How are you, Judge?
Being a Common Sense Democrat, thank you.
And Common Sense Democrat, Governor Patterson, how are you?
I have some common sense.
And our borough president from Staten Island, a common sense Republican. How are you, Vito? Vito Fisella.
I don't even have 2 cents. So.
We need a loan. We'll be happy to help you.
You're criticizing Washington again? They took all your money away?
That's it, inflation. It was 3 cents last year.
Instead of Lydia Serrani, who we miss, is out sick today, and we have Dominic Carter, who's not wearing a red dress. He's wearing a dark suit.
But he's wearing he's wearing a red tie, and we're happy to have you here, Dominic.
Hey, it's an honor always to be here. I hope that Lydia feels better, and it's great to be here with you, Mr. Katzimatidis.
I understand now we have our senator from Alaska, which we had a great discussion with a couple of weeks ago. And Senator Dan Sullivan, is it?
Yes.
Senator, how are you today?
Hey, John, Happy New Year. It's great to be on your show again.
Thank you. Happy New Year. It is colder today in New York than it is in Alaska.
Well, it depends on what part of Alaska, right?
You got it.
We're now, a big state, as you know.
There's been big controversy. We've been talking about it, that we are buying our oil from Putin, paying him $90 a barrel, and OPEC paying them $89, $90 a barrel. And Alaska, you got a $2 million a day pipeline that you're only using 400,000 barrels. Why aren't we buying more from Alaska?
Well, look, it's a great question. It's the critical question. And the answer is we should be buying more. And it's the broader approach of this administration. I did a press conference with a bunch of my Republican colleagues yesterday on the one-year anniversary of the Biden administration. And I focused, John, on this very issue. You know, it's really important to remember what Biden inherited in terms of energy. 4 years of the Trump administration with Republicans in control of the U.S. Senate, we finally achieved our long-standing bipartisan goal of American energy independence. Biggest producer of oil in the world, bigger than Saudi Arabia, biggest producer of natural gas in the world, bigger than Russia, the biggest producer of renewables. And when Biden came in, he focused on destroying this, all of it, energy independence. And, you know, what did we get? You just mentioned it. We're importing 2 times as much oil from Russia today than we were at the beginning of the Biden administration. And they're begging OPEC to produce oil while they're trying to shut down oil production in my great state, killing oil pipelines like Keystone while approving Putin's pipeline, Nord Stream 2. That's what Biden did. And then they're strong-arming financial institutions and the regulatory state to get to not get our financial
Killing of America.
American energy. It's crazy.
The killing of America. Now, we're paying Putin now. We're buying almost 1 million barrels a day. We're paying him $90 a barrel, or just about. And he's going to use that money to attack the Ukraine. What say you about that?
It's crazy. And here's the other thing. You know, we keep threatening these sanctions, but all of a sudden Putin is awash in money. So even the sanctions that we normally can put on other countries that will have a big impact have a much lesser impact when he's got so much money from oil, and a lot of it are exports of Russian oil to the United States. We should be producing our own oil from my state and others. It makes no sense. The only thing that's going on here, because I've asked, what are they up to? It's not just hurting our foreign policy, driving energy prices up on working families. It's killing the American working family with the high cost of energy. Now, the only thing that is going on here, John, it's a narrative for the entire first year of the Biden administration. They're doing all these crazy policies to placate the radical far left. That's it.
Are we going to have a war in the Ukraine? What say you?
I hope we don't have a war in the Ukraine. You know, the president, of course, had to walk back his statement yesterday, which was a shocker. You know, hey, it's okay for a minor incursion. What? Are you kidding me? Of course that's not okay. What we should be doing now, though, from my perspective, is getting the Ukrainians as much weapon systems as possible, the Javelin system, anti-ship systems that they can protect themselves on. We need deterrence. The other thing that we didn't blow, but you may have seen, we had a very big vote in the U.S. Senate on major sanctions against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. All the Republicans and Democrats, when President Trump was in office, were for this. Don't let that pipeline, it's Putin's pipeline, it enriches him. He uses gas as a weapon against the Europeans. Don't let it happen. Well, Biden greenlighted it. So we voted last week in the Senate, and all these Dems who were strong against Putin when Trump was president all of a sudden got weak and flipped their votes. So we need to do all we can against Putin in terms of his ability to use energy as a weapon, and in my view, getting as many weapon systems to Ukrainians to be able to defend themselves if the Russians do invade.
A senator we had today, I talked to Admiral Stavridis this morning, who was charge of NATO for 4 years. And he's going to be on Sunday's show, but I have a one-minute tidbit on him, and I want your opinion on it. Can we play Admiral Stavridis' tidbit?
There's one important question as a former naval officer that I'd like you to answer. And I understand you have a new book I want to talk about. We only have 2 minutes left. Hypersonic weapons. These missiles travel at almost 1 mile a second. If you were an admiral on a $25 billion aircraft carrier, would you worry?
Yes, I would. And Russia and China are moving rapidly. And unfortunately, John, I would say they are a bit ahead of the United States on creating these hypersonic cruise missiles. They go 7 times the speed of sound, and they can maneuver at the end game. So they're a very difficult target. Now, we do have ways to defend our carriers. We have destroyers and cruisers that have missiles. We can create directed energy weapons, but we have a ways to go in defending against these hypersonics. They're a big concern to the Pentagon right now, and you're smart to raise that issue.
Wow. And, you know, those hypersonic missiles are traveling at 1 mile a second. And how would you like to be on a $25 billion aircraft carrier, Senator? And one of those things are coming at you.
Well, you know, John, I have a lot of respect for the admiral. And I think, you know, I'm a colonel in the Marine Corps. As a matter of fact, tomorrow I'm heading out for 10 days of a Marine Corps and a broader exercise and putting my uniform on out in the Pacific Theater. So I'm heading out there tomorrow for the next 10 days and as a Marine. But I will tell you this, a lot of this goes into what you're doing with your DOD, Department of Defense budget, and where you're focusing the research dollars. I believe the admiral is right. Now, look, we're not I probably can't talk about some of this openly here, but we're doing a lot in hypersonics, too, in ways to defend it. But here's the bigger issue. The National Democrat Party, Biden, Schumer, Pelosi, look at what they do. Obama, whenever they get into office, they put forward budgets that cut the military. Obama's second term cut defense spending by 25%. It was one of the big reasons I ran for the U.S. Senate in the first place. I had never run for anything. I never run for dog catcher. But when you're cutting the military, the U.S., by 25%, they gutted our readiness. They gutted it. And we built it back over the last 5 years. Biden comes in, his first budget as the new president, he double increases, double digits, every federal agency but two, Homeland Security and Department of Defense. He put in a budget to cut them. It's outrageous when we have these challenges from Russia and China that the admiral is talking about to put forward a budget to cut defense spending. Schumer supported it. Pelosi supported it. Bernie Sanders, of course, supported it. The good news is we just passed the Defense Authorization Act last month. President signed into law. It was a total rebuke to all of them. It increased defense spending in these key areas on the overall top-line budget. And we got to do that to have a lethal and ready military. It's a huge issue I focus on literally every day as a U.S. senator.
Cats at Night with John Catsimatidis. We are talking live, John Catsimatidis, that is, with Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan. Cats at Night, good afternoon, Mr. Catsimatidis.
Well, how was your day, too?
mine was well, but, you know, well, Judge, did you have a question for the Senator? Because what I'm trying to figure out, well, go ahead. I'll ask mine after you're done.
Okay. Thank you. That's judicial deference. Is that what that is? Senator, nice to talk to you again, sir.
Hey, Judge, it was great being on the show last time with you.
We had a wonderful time.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, sir. I want to ask you about this bill that you've introduced into the Senate, the Standing with Taiwan Act. Would you explain that to our listeners, please?
Sure. I just introduced it yesterday. And, you know, again, I mentioned I'm heading out to the Pacific Theater tomorrow as a Marine colonel. But the Taiwan issue has kind of bookended my entire career. My first deployment as a Marine was in 95 and 96. And you might remember that's when the Chinese military was threatening to invade Taiwan back then. That was called, it's now referred to as the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis, because the Chinese moved the PLA up to the Taiwan Strait. They started shooting missiles over Taiwan, all because Taiwan was on the eve of its first presidential election, and they hated the idea that there was going to be democracy in Taiwan. To President Clinton's credit, he sent two carrier strike groups, two, and a Marine Amphibious Task Force. And I was a young infantry officer on that Marine Amphibious Task Force. The ship I was on actually went through the Taiwan Strait, but it was a very strong showing of American commitment and resolve to the island democracy of Taiwan. My bill that I introduced yesterday doesn't talk about military. We need to focus on the military, that's for sure. But one of the most important ways I think we can deter the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army from attacking and militarily invading Taiwan is to let them know, hey, if you do this, the sanctions that will be mandated by the United States in terms of economic and financial will be overwhelming and crippling to your country. So my bill simply says if the Chinese Communist Party initiates a military invasion of Taiwan, there will be mandatory sanctions that will cripple the Communist Party, the leaders of that party, and key sectors of the Chinese economy. It will show Xi Jinping right now, if you do this, the costs militarily are going to be high, but the costs from your economy's perspective might even be higher. So that's the point. I think I can get a lot of Democrat and Republican senators to support it. I got a strong Marine Congressman, Mike Gallagher, in the House who introduced the same piece of legislation yesterday with me. It's all about deterrence, Judge, and it's not just military deterrence. We think this is important deterrence, too.
Senator Dan Sullivan, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for speaking out, and good luck in the Pacific.
Hey, thanks, John. Always great to be on the show with you and the judge and others, and I look forward to doing it again.
Be well, senators.
Good luck and stay safe.
Thank you, sir.
Now, we also this afternoon taped a one-minute piece or two-minute piece with Dick Morris, and he's coming on Sunday, and he's got his own show on Sunday between 12 and 1. And I would like the governor's opinion on it and Dominic Carter's opinion on it and Vito's and the judge. Let's play that that piece that's going to appear on Sunday's show.
I did a poll with John Jordan. We did it together. And John McLaughlin, Trump's pollster, was the guy who took the survey, in which we interviewed 1,000 black voters in the U.S. And our goal was to find out what it is that would make them switch to the Republican Party. And what we found is that the Republican Party is about to double its vote share among black voters. You know, it's been creeping up over the years. In 2012, 5% voted Republican. In 2016, 9% did. And in 2020, 15% did. Now it looks like as many as 25 to 30% of the black voters may be ready to vote Republican. We're seeing in the poll a huge surge in sentiment among particularly black voters who are under the age of 55 and who are employed. The older black voters are still loyal to the Democrats, but the younger black voters, who are the majority, are increasingly disaffected from the Democrats. We found out that almost 60% of them said that they felt that their affection for the Democratic Party was less than it had been in the past. And almost two-thirds said they felt taken for granted by the Democrats, and that the Democrats just treat them like the given and don't do anything to help them.
Well, that's part of the interview that will appear on Sunday on the Cats Roundtable. Governor, what do you think?
Well, I think that sentiment that was polled in black voters is also existing with white voters. And it has to do with people's capacity to get a decent education, to hold jobs, to get promoted, to have quality of life. Now, I think the black community, we've always been misunderstood by Republicans and Democrats, because if you take out the racism that we've endured, if you take out the disparate impact of institutional policy for hundreds of years that have made it more difficult for African Americans, and if you just take out all of those factors, the black community is a very religious community, which is well known, and it also is a community of conservatism in terms of social activities. And so that kind of coincides a little more these days with the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, which is giving in too often to the kind of socialist reasoning which the black community has had issues with in the past. Socialists were all over Dr. King's civil rights movement, and even the Communist Party was all over his movement back in the 50s and was rejected, because rather than fighting for the rights of black people, they just wanted to use African Americans to have control over and then use that for their own political means. So I could see why those numbers are going up. I doubt that it would be 25 to 30%, but I can see how those numbers are going up.
Dominic Carter?
Ditto to the point that was just articulated by Governor Patterson. I, too, doubt the numbers will go that high, but I believe that Dick Morris is on to something in terms of the polling. The bottom line, Mr. Katsimatidis, people are tired for being taken for granted. No one wants to be taken for granted. And I think that President Trump made some inroads. We know the numbers show this with communities of color, with historical black universities and black colleges, the money that Trump put up. And I think that what's universal for everyone these days is law and order. And frankly speaking, many of the victims of crimes happen to be African Americans, in terms of black-on-black crime. And people don't want to be taken for granted, and they want to be safe. So I can believe, Mr. Catsimatidis, that those numbers are going up for the Republican Party.
Now, Vito Fisella, you got almost 70%, I think, of the Staten Island vote. What percentage do you think you got from the black vote?
I haven't seen the numbers. It was about 60%. If I had the other line, perhaps it would have been about 70%. But let me just sort of say this. Whenever I've run, and fortunately the good people of Staten Island have elected me every time I've run in the city council, Congress, and now borough president, my approach has always been to treat everybody the same. I believe you got to speak honestly to individuals, whether they're black or white or brown. If I happen to believe that a strong educational system is the best path to prosperity and to success, so therefore we need good schools, good teachers, a safe and secure environment. That applies to black and white people. I think you want to create a situation where if people want to go into business, there aren't regulations that punish them or taxes that crush them, and that's black or brown or white. So I think that when you speak honestly, openly, you don't generalize, you don't stereotype, you see it. I believe on Staten Island, for example, in there are little maybe pockets of one or two bad schools, let's say, it's overwhelmingly black population, those parents don't want their kids in that school. They want a better school. And those are the things, and that's the language that I speak. Fortunately, to this day, as I mentioned at the outset, it has prevailed. I can look back over the last 27 years or so and feel that haven't changed that at all. And frankly, to Dominic's point, if there are people who are taken advantage of, just like, oh, they're all with us, I think that's terrible. I think that's awful to sort of assume that this large group of wonderful people are just in somebody's pocket, and I think that should stop.
And the Democratic Party has assumed that in the past.
I think they still do.
We got to take a break, and when we come back, I believe we have Larry Kudlow to tell us what the heck is going on with the economy.
A common sense recap of the day's biggest stories. It's John Catsimatidis and Cats at Night on 77 WABC.
Welcome back. This is Cats at Night. John Catsimatidis here, and with us today is Larry Kudlow to tell us where are we? Where's the economy going? How are you, Larry?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. I mean, it's cold out there, and I just heard the Breakers commercial. I think I wish we could get on the airplane and go head right down.
Last time I talked to you, you were in Miami. I'm always here.
And Connecticut is a little bit closer. Colder.
Yeah, well, it's pretty cold in New York. It's a pretty cold stock market, which continues to get slammed. And the NASDAQ is now 14% below its November peak. And the Dow and the S&P are down for the third consecutive week. There's a lot of worries out there right now. I mean, you had Biden's press conference where instead of shifting gears away from big government socialism, he was kind of doubling up. And he said, the problem isn't his policies, and the people really love him. It's he has to go around the country and communicate better on these policies. I beg to differ. I think that that people are not buying the product that he's selling, and he's in denial about inflation. And this Build Back Better, which is now Build Back Smaller or Build Back Chunkier, none of that stuff's going to go through. We continue to save America and kill the bill, but he was very stubborn. He botched everything on Ukraine. The Ukraine story looks worse and worse, John. That may be weighing on the stock market, too. I mean, today, for example, the State Department issued a statement saying they're going to start to evacuate the Kiev embassy, the U.S. embassy in Kiev. We had Senator Roger Wicker on, who was just in Ukraine. The Ukrainians themselves expect a Soviet invasion of some kind. Biden blundered at the press conference by saying it might have been a minor incursion. That was crazy. They tried to walk it back, but then they walked it back, and it raised even more questions. You know, we are reacting to Putin. We are not out there taking steps to prevent this. like shutting them out of the world banking system or stopping the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So you've got
We're feeding Putin all this money. We're paying him almost $90 a barrel for almost a million barrels a day. So we are supplying the money for him to fight the war.
$90 million worth.
To some extent, that's true. That's the way it works out. But you see, we've been in this reactive mode. You know, we should have slapped the Nord Stream sanctions back on, never should have lifted them in the first place. We should change our whole energy policy. This Green New Deal thing is killing fossil fuels, pipelines, drilling, fracking. Oil is expensive, and it's not in good supply. So, yeah, you're running up towards the $90 a barrel. That's correct. There's no telling what will happen. You've got four NATO countries surrounding the Ukraine. So you could have a blow-up in there that might have very nasty consequences. Also at home, the inflation rate continues. Consumer spending is softening. Profits look a little softer. Interest rates are rising. Janet Yellen yesterday said the inflation rate by the end of this year is going to be 2%. I don't know what she's smoking. Actually, she spoke to this crazy Davos conference of worldwide corporate socialists, and she tried to make a case that this is a modern supply-side program. But what she was basically describing is a big government socialist program. More spending, more child allowances, more teachers' money, tax cuts don't work, deregulation doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. Basically ignoring the facts of the Trump tax cuts and deregulation and energy independence. So this is a very uncertain moment, John. That's all I can say.
The price of gasoline has doubled. Before crude oil continues to go up, that means there's a whole round of additional price increases in food in the next 60 days. How could Janet Yellen say 2% by the end of the year?
Larry, what do you think the inflation rate might be by the end of the year?
Not less than 5, and it could be as high as 8 or 10.
I agree with Larry.
I'm going to assume that the $5 trillion big government socialist spending plan is defeated. I'm going to assume that. But right now, if you have a zero target rate and a 7% CPI, real rates minus 7%, that is easy, loose money. In other words, the Fed hasn't even started to fight all of the increased money. They haven't started to withdraw it from the banking system. And they got so much more work to do than they will admit, or a lot of people in the market will admit. The 10-year is hovering around 170, 180. I think it's going to go to 3%, and I think that's going to damage stock market valuations, even if profits rise moderately. Profits are the mother's milk of stocks, but they're not going to rise, you know, at 20, 25% like they have been. And then you've got a problem. Real wages are falling because of the inflation. People are working. Jobs are okay. Unemployment is low. But inflation is a tax on middle-income folks, and I think that may start to take its toll. So I don't want to be excessively pessimistic. The cavalry is coming. The GOP is going to do very, very well next November. The worst of its, the federal takeover of election law is being defeated. There's not going to break the filibuster. I don't think the big government socialist bill is going to pass. So that's good. That's okay.
And company earnings are going to be very good for fourth quarter 21 and first quarter 22.
Well, we'll see. I don't think they're going to be as strong. I think they're being overestimated right now. I think they're going to continue to rise, which is very, very important for the stock market, for a kind of backstop for stocks. But I don't think they're going to rise as fast as some people do. I don't think the economy is going to be as rapid in growth. I think the growth slows down maybe 2, 3%. I think the first quarter, John, Omicron is taking a bigger toll in certain sectors, not because of deaths and hospitalizations, thankfully, but because people are staying home. A lot of these big blue states have panicked. You know, New York is making everybody stay at home. Here at Fox, we're having to abide by all these crazy city rules. You know, two people in, four people out. You can't sit on the same set with somebody. It's really crazy. The office buildings are not filling up the way they should be. And then, look, more generally speaking, we still have a crime problem. We got no bail, no jail, district attorney. We got a governor that doesn't want to fight it. The mayor is very ambiguous about it. And all these cities across the country, I mean, great American cities. Okay, New York, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco. These are great cities, and we want to keep them great.
And we want to make them great again. I mean, we're losing Los Angeles. We're losing San Francisco. Did you hear that comment from Union Pacific that they may want to pull out of L.A. or California?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm just saying, you're not going to return these cities to greatness until you clean the streets off. Okay? You have to clean the streets off. I don't mean to sound hard-hearted. I understand mental problems. I understand addiction problems. But these things should be treated while in incarceration. You cannot allow these homeless villages to take over and swallow the cities. And you cannot have local law authorities say no bail, no jail. This has to be tightened up enormously, and it's not yet happening.
Larry Kudlow, thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for speaking out on behalf of the economy in our country. God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you.
Let's take a break, and we're going to be coming back with Kathy Wild, she's a CEO of the New York City Partnership, and had a meeting on Zoom with Alvin Bragg this morning, and she's going to talk about it, about safety in our city and how the corporate executives feel about it and how Alvin Bragg felt about it. Let's take a break first.
John Katz and the D's. 77 WABC.
Well, we're back, and the big concern of New York City, and we're going to be talking about it internally. And on the phone with us, we have Kathy Wild. She's the CEO of the New York City Partnership. And today, she had most of her members on a Zoom call with the new DA in New York City, in Manhattan, Alvin Bragg. And when I'll tell you, every one of those CEOs was concerned. Kathy Wild, please give the people of New York a report. How did that Zoom call do?
Thank you, John. The meeting this morning was really called at the request of the city's business leaders because they are very concerned about the status of crime in the city, of the personal safety of their employees. One of the CEOs on the call was the head of Deloitte, whose employee was killed last Saturday when pushed in front of a subway train, and he described how the ripple effects through his thousands of employees, and in fact, the tens of thousands of people who work around the Times Square area, it's just really created a tremendous fear for personal safety and for what is happening to our city. And the message the business community wanted to deliver was, if these conditions continue to deteriorate, if our people are at risk, our responsibility is their health and safety. How can we ask them to come back to the office? How can we stay in New York City? I mean, it is a existential issue for them. So that was the subject of the meeting. I have to say that DA Alvin Bragg was extremely responsive, listened carefully, clarified some of the policies that they had heard read that that they were most worried about, like, will armed robbery be prosecuted as a felony? And he said, yes, it will. And he said that abuse of the police, attacks on police will not be tolerated. And he really responded very constructively to a lot of the concerns. So it was a good first step meeting. The proof will be in the pudding, but it was a positive meeting, and he committed himself to work with Mayor Adams and the police department to make sure that we turn around and head in a more positive direction.
I was on the call, and Judge Weinberg was on the call, and I think D.A. Bragg realizes that the business community, and I think he agreed to more meetings in the future.
Yes.
So I think he knows that people are watching, and we're not ignoring the situation, and we're concerned about the situation. Judge Weinberg, did you find that?
Well, I want to commend you, Kathy, for putting that meeting together. I thought it was a wonderful conference call. I think Alvin Bragg tried to explain his 22-page memo was never intended for publication. It's supposed to be an internal document. Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone was particularly strong in sending out the message, look, that memo is being read as a hands-off on law enforcement. You're creating a climate of lawlessness. You have to address it. You cannot say, this is what I'm not going to do. You have to start telling people what they are going to do to restore confidence that you can walk the streets safely, ride the subway safely, the employees can come back to the office safely. Other people pointed out, Kathy, as well, thought is very, very important in the real estate industry. They're worried about people leaving the city because they're afraid of their kids going to school in the city. And if they start leaving the city,
the kids don't want to be in the subways.
Right. So if the kids start leaving and are afraid, and the parents say, we're going to the suburbs, we're going out of state, that's a death knell for the city.
So this
Vito, good thing you don't have subways in Staten Island.
Yeah, but a lot of that's the reality of what we've said from day one when this happened. There's a lot of people from Staten Island who work in the city, who go to school in the city,
yes,
who want to go to restaurants in the city and want to enjoy New York City. So they share those subway platforms with Manhattan residents, which is why it's so insane. And pleased to hear Kathy and the business leaders put this on the table front and center, because without public safety, we don't have anything.
Now, Kathy, this is David Paris, and I'm really glad that you all had that meeting. I'm still a little confused, and perhaps you and John and Judge Weinberg, since you were on the call, can explain this. Is the DA saying that I am changing my mind and I'm going to do things differently than what I had written in my memo, or was he in a sense just sort of acquiescing for the benefit of those in the conversation but not necessarily changing his mind?
Well, he was just elected to public office, and so it's a little hard to stand up and say the first thing I'm doing is changing my mind. But the important thing was he listened. He clearly got it. He is a smart man. He responded in a way that made people feel that he's recognizing that at least the way he presented the policies and certainly the implications of his policies were not balanced in a way that reassured people that he cared both about improving public safety as well as about fairness and justice in the system. And so, I mean, the suggestion, actually, one suggestion that was made at the meeting was we'd like a memo that says what you plan to do, as opposed to so much of his original memo was about what they won't do or how they'll dial back in certain areas of prosecution, incarceration. They said, can we have a memo of what you will do to reassure people, and particularly their employees. I'll tell you, I just read after the meeting, JetBlue sent the CEO of JetBlue, Robin Hayes, sent a memo to 22,000 of his employees telling them about the meeting and saying that he felt much more confident afterwards. And during the meeting, I'm sure John and Richard will agree, he made Robin Hayes made a very impassioned statement about how he rides the subways every day, and he's nervous about it, and his employees, the women are carrying mace, and they're, he made a very strong pitch, so he felt better afterwards, and I think to the extent that D.A. Bragg did a very good job of reassuring people that he was taking these issues seriously, that he understands the importance of his collaboration with the police department, that he has to have that relationship to bring back a sense of security to the city. So I think it was a good meeting. I think he showed himself to be very responsive and very much sharing in our concerns about what it will mean to the future of our city if we don't fix what's broke in this system.
Madam President, Dominic Carter speaking. So your
Dominic, so nice to hear from you.
So nice to hear from you as well.
Dominic has been lost at midnight. Now I'm glad you're at 5 o'clock today. I'd like to bring it to everybody's attention. Dominic Carter has the number one show at midnight every night, Monday through Friday.
Thank you,
and your
sir.
Ratings are very high, and a lot of people are listening to you.
Thank
you, Dominic,
sir.
And I go way
we
back.
We do. And it's an honor to chat with you. And you've been on the front line as a leader in this city. And I trust your instincts as the president of the New York City Partnership. So, and CEO, do you feel much better right now than you did, let's say, 24 hours ago, as it relates to Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg?
Absolutely. Yes, I do. I really think that he listened. I saw during the meeting, I think things were communicated to him that he hadn't really thought about before this conversation or considered fully. And so I really, you know, when I see somebody respond in a genuine, authentic way, that makes me feel good. And he's clearly an effective and smart prosecutor, which he's been doing for a number of years.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Kathy.
He knows he's under observation, and people are going to be watching what he does, and the business community is going to be watching what he does. And the truth, I think Hochul's job is going to depend on law and order in our city.
One thing that I read recently is that the private school attendance of students, the students that attend private school, is down 9%. Now, that means the reason that they're not there is that their families have moved out of the city. So it's an indicator of how many families that can afford to do it are leaving the city at a time when we're going to need them for taxes, we're going to need them for other things, and we're just not going to get that support.
Absolutely. And one of the things the employers said today is this is, you know, people leaving the city, people being afraid, it's not about the COVID anymore. It's about the safety of their commute, their safety on the streets of the city. And so this is the front burner issue that we have to deal with.
We all agree 100%. Kathy Wild, thank you for bringing it to everybody's attention. Please keep it in front of everybody and let all, not only DA Bragg, let all the politicians know that we are watching it, and the business community wants to bring New York back to the greatest city in the world.
Thank you, John. And next week I'm setting up a meeting along those lines with Deputy Mayor Phil Banks and with our new police commissioner, and hopefully we'll take the next step in making sure that we're keeping the pressure on.
Kathy Wild, thank you, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
Now, Borough President Vito Fisella, I understand you're having an inauguration tomorrow. Tell us about it.
I'm very, very fortunate we're going to do it tomorrow. And before we go into that, John, I was just following up on what Kathy said. You know, the public safety, law and order, it's important and critical. It's not just one person or one incident. I was with one of the high-ranking people in the Adams administration today, and they seem to be taking it very seriously, too. In other words, they're proceeding not necessarily exclusively on bail reform, which we think needs to be changes, but our gun cases, people who are arrested with guns, are they seeing speedy trials? Are they taken off the streets?
Vito, if they took 1,000 bad people off the streets,
yep,
and put the people that should be in hospitals,
this will be a greatest city of the world
for,
again.
For example, I was told last night that the transit aspect of the police used to have a way in which they got homeless or mentally ill patients off the subway platforms and got them the care they need, and that's not really in place anymore. So, you know, I hate to be Monday morning quarterback, but if that person wasn't on that platform the other day, that young lady would still be with us. So with all that said, you know, the inauguration will be tomorrow, Monsignor Farrell High School. We're expecting a nice crowd. Just blessed that the people of Staten Island give me the opportunity and honor to serve them.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve it.
Congratulations.
You're doing a great job. And
absolutely.
Thank you all very much.
Great public servant, Fido.
Thank you, Cousin.
Are we taking a break before we got Dr. Peter Mihalos?
You're commuting home with Cats at Night. Now, here's John Katsimatidis on 77 WABC.
Cats at Night, we are back, and we're going to have Dr. Mihalos. But before we take Dr. Mihalos, Vito Fisella, that Staten Island Ferry was sold yesterday to a couple of your constituents.
Yeah, Colin Joseph and especially Peter Davidson, who we're very, very proud of. I've known Peter since he's a young boy, and we couldn't be more proud of what he's been able to accomplish. His mom, Amy, is just a dear friend of ours. But frankly, the best Davidson is his younger sister, Casey. She's number one. But so I was mentioning about the fact that they bought the Staten Island Ferry, want to make an entertainment venue, so it seems. So I asked his mother, Amy, if she wanted me to say anything, and she said yes, just tell him Pete's mom is single and ready to mingle, and that anybody interested should send a resume to me with pictures and net worth, and because she's very, very shallow.
$400, I'll accept it. Dr. So Peter anyway, Mihalos.
Good luck to the crew.
Tell us what's going on with Omicron.
Well, we're keeping our eyes open for a new antibody dodging variant. That's what we're worrying about, but we're hoping that this fast-spreading Omicron variant is helping us reach collective immunity or herd immunity, which is how we've gotten out of pandemics in the past. A great news from the World Health Organization that they found that an arthritis drug, baricitinib, which blocks the cytokine storm, is really helping the severe COVID patients get off ventilators and helping their lungs slow down the cytokine storm. So that's great news in the last 48 hours out of the World Health Organization. And what we're finding out is injection or infection builds immunity, but we still don't have a firm answer on how long protection lasts. And vaccines are really a dress rehearsal for a real COVID infection, preparing us for the real thing. And the data out of Israel is suggesting that the people who've been vaccinated have a much lower chance of getting long-haul COVID syndrome or post-COVID syndrome, as they refer to it, which is fatigue, shortness of breath, brain fog, headaches, loss of smell, taste, insomnia, and depression. And 20% of people who have had asymptomatic documented diagnosis ended up with this long-haul COVID syndrome out of the Israeli study. And 50% of people who need to be hospitalized have long-haul COVID issues. They've shown 26% fatigue, 22% headaches, and 10% loss of concentration and insomnia. The great news is also that the man-made antibodies by GlaxoSmithKline, which bind and grab the infected cells and stop them from multiplying, reduce the death rate and hospitalization by 80%, and people are getting those out there. We do have a very slow start to the oral antiviral pills because they only delivered 1,600 doses to New York City the first week of January when we had 30,000 new cases a day. So we need to turn on Operation Warp Speed, and we have to give credit again to Operation Warp Speed, which is a shining example of how tort reform and restricting lawsuits against medical innovation brought us life-saving medicines within 10 months of a pandemic. And we have to be careful with all this talk about price controls with medicine, because that results in shortages of the supply and will stifle research and development of new therapies.
Dr. Mihalos, I understand the Theraflu-type pill for the virus is not available yet?
Well, it is, but like I just said, only 1,600 doses were delivered to New York City.
That's
when
nothing.
We're having 30,000 cases a day.
Nothing.
Exactly. So the fortunately, a lot of the antibody was manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline, invented by Dr. George Skangos at Vir Pharma in California. And that is working, and it's helping people get through this.
Dr. Mihalos, thank you for being on here and telling me all New Yorkers the truth. God bless you. And Governor Patterson, thank you for being here.
Thank you, John.
Borough President Vito Fisella, Big inauguration tomorrow. Congratulations again.
Thank you, Judge.
Judge Richard Weinberg, thank you for being here, too. And Dominic Carter, I'm going to be listening tonight between 12 and 1, Monday through Friday, and on WABC Radio. And you are in 30 states at midnight because we have a clear channel station.
It is. It's fantastic, and it's all thanks to you, Mr. Katsimatidis, and your wife, Margot Katsimatidis.
God bless you. Woo-hoo. God bless New York. God bless America.